Another well-known specialist warned that the general strategy of preventive war is likely to provide others with overwhelming incentives to wield weapons of terror and mass destruction as a deterrent to the unbridled use of American power. Many have noted the likely impetus to Iranian nuclear weapons programs. And there is no question that the lesson that the North Koreans have learned from Iraq is that it needs a nuclear deterrent, Selig Harrison commented. As the year 2002 drew to a close, Washington was teaching an ugly lesson to the world. If you want to defend yourself from us, you had better mimic North Korea and pose a credible military threat. In this case, conventional, artillery aimed at Seoul and at U.S. troops near the DMZ. We will enthusiastically march on to attack Iraq because we know that it is devastated and defenseless. But North Korea, though an even worse tyranny and vastly more dangerous, is not an appropriate target as long as it can cause plenty of harm. The lesson could hardly be more vivid. Still another concern is the second superpower, public opinion. Not only was the revisionism of the political leadership without precedent, so too was the opposition to it. Comparisons are often drawn to Vietnam. The common query, what happened to the tradition of protest and dissent, makes clear how effectively the historical record has been cleansed and how little sense there is, in many circles, of the changes in public consciousness over the past four decades. An accurate comparison is revealing. In 1962, public protest was non-existent, despite the announcement that year that the Kennedy administration was sending the U.S. Air Force to bomb South Vietnam, as well as initiating plans to drive millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps and launching chemical warfare programs to destroy food crops and ground cover. Protest did not reach any meaningful level until years later, after hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops had been dispatched, densely populated areas had been demolished by saturation bombing, and the aggression had spread to the rest of Indochina. By the time protest became significant, the bitterly anti-communist military historian and Indochina specialist Bernard Fall had warned that Vietnam, as a cultural and historic entity, is threatened with extinction as the countryside literally dies under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed on an area of this size. In 2002, 40 years later, in striking contrast, there was large-scale, committed, and principled popular protest before the war had been officially launched. Absent the fear and illusion about Iraq that were unique to the U.S., pre-war opposition would probably have reached much the same levels as elsewhere. That reflects a steady increase over these years in unwillingness to tolerate aggression and atrocities, one of many such changes. The leadership is well aware of these developments. By 1968, fear of the public was so serious that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to consider whether sufficient forces would still be available for civil disorder control if more troops were sent to Vietnam. The Department of Defense feared that further troop deployments ran the risk of provoking a domestic crisis of unprecedented proportions. The Reagan administration at first tried to follow Kennedy's South Vietnam model in Central America, but backed down in the face of an unanticipated public reaction that threatened to undermine more important components of the policy agenda, turning instead to clandestine terror. Clandestine in the sense that it could be more or less concealed from the general public. When the first Bush took office in 1989, public reaction was again very much on the agenda. Incoming administrations typically commission a review of the world situation from the intelligence agencies. These reviews are secret, but in 1989 a passage was leaked concerning cases where the U.S. confronts much weaker enemies. The analysts advised that the U.S. must defeat them decisively and rapidly. Any other outcome would be embarrassing and might undercut political support, understood to be thin. We are no longer in the 1960s, when the population would tolerate a murderous and destructive war for years without visible protest. The activist movements of the past 40 years have had a significant civilizing effect in many domains. By now, the only way to attack a much weaker enemy is to construct a propaganda offensive depicting it as an imminent threat, or perhaps engaged in genocide, with confidence that the military campaign will scarcely resemble an actual war. Elite concerns extend to the impact of Bush administration radical nationalists on world public opinion, which was overwhelmingly opposed to their war plans and militant posturing. These have surely been factors in the general decline of trust in leadership revealed by a World Economic Forum poll released in January 2003. According to the poll, only NGO leaders had the trust of a clear majority, followed by UN and spiritual religious leaders, then leaders of Western Europe and economic managers, and right below them, corporate executives. Far below, at the very bottom, were the leaders of the United States. A week after the poll was released, The annual World Economic Forum opened in Davos, Switzerland, but without the exuberance of earlier years. The mood has darkened, the press noted. For the movers and shakers, it was not global party time anymore. The founder of the WEF, Klaus Schwab, identified the most pressing reason. Iraq will be the overwhelming theme of all the discussions. Powell's aides warned him before his presentation that the mood was ugly at Davos, the Wall Street Journal reported. A chorus of international complaints about the American march toward war with Iraq was reaching a crescendo at this gathering of some 2,000 corporate executives, politicians, and academics. They were not overwhelmed by Powell's sharp new message. In his own words, "When we feel strongly about something, we will lead, even if no one is following us. We will act even if others are not prepared to join us." The theme of the WEF was building trust, for good reasons. In his speech, Powell stressed that the U.S. reserves the sovereign right to take military action, when and how it chooses. He said further that no one trusts Saddam and his regime, which was certainly true, though his comment left out some other leaders who are not trusted. Powell also assured his audience that Saddam Hussein's weapons were meant to intimidate Iraq's neighbors, failing to explain why those neighbors did not seem to perceive the threat. Much as they despise the murderous tyrant, Iraq's neighbors joined the many outside the United States mystified at why Washington is so obsessed and fearful of what is, in the end, a minor power whose wealth and power have been truncated by internationally imposed constraints. Aware of the dire effects of the sanctions on the general population, they also knew that Iraq was one of the weakest states in the region. Its economy and military expenditures were a fraction of Kuwait's, which has 10% of Iraq's population, and much farther below those of others nearby. For these and other reasons, the neighboring countries had been mending fences with Iraq for some years over strong U.S. opposition. Like the U.S. Department of Defense and the CIA, they knew perfectly well that today's Iraq poses no threat to anyone in the region, let alone in the United States, and that to argue otherwise is dishonest. By the time they met, the movers and shakers at Davos had heard even more unpleasant news about building trust. An opinion poll in Canada found that more than 36% of Canadians viewed the U.S. as the biggest threat to world peace, against just 21% naming Al-Qaeda, 17% choosing Iraq, and 14% North Korea. That despite the fact that the general image of the U.S. had improved to 72% in Canada, in contrast to dropping sharply in Western Europe. An informal poll run by Time magazine found that more than 80% of respondents in Europe regarded the U.S. as the greatest threat to world peace. Even if these numbers were wrong by some substantial factor, they are dramatic. Their significance is magnified by contemporaneous international polls on the U.S.-UK drive for war with Iraq. The messages from U.S. embassies around the globe have become urgent and disturbing, the Washington Post noted in a lead story. Many people in the world increasingly think President Bush is a greater threat to world peace than Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The debate has not been about Iraq, a State Department official was quoted as saying. There is real angst in the world about our power and what they perceive as the rawness, the arrogance, the unipolarity of the administration's actions. The headline read, "Danger Ahead? The World Sees President Bush as a Threat." A cover story in Newsweek 3 weeks later by its senior foreign affairs editor also warned that the global debate was not about Saddam. It is about America and its role in the new world. A war with Iraq, even if successful, might solve the Iraq problem. It doesn't solve the America problem. What worries people around the world above all else is living in a world shaped and dominated by one country, the United States. And they have come to be deeply suspicious and fearful of us. After 9/11, at a time of enormous global sympathy and solidarity with the United States, George Bush asked, "Why do they hate us?" The question was wrongly put, and the right question was scarcely addressed. But within a year, the administration succeeded in providing an answer. "Because of you and your associates, Mr. Bush, and what you have done. And if you continue, the fear and hatred you have inspired may extend to the country you have shamed as well." On that, the evidence is hard to ignore. For Osama bin Laden, it is a victory probably beyond his wildest dreams. Intentional ignorance. The fundamental assumption that lies behind the imperial grand strategy, often considered unnecessary to formulate because its truth is taken to be so obvious, is the guiding principle of Wilsonian idealism. We, at least the circles who provide the leadership and advise them, are good, even noble. Hence our interventions are necessarily righteous in intent, if occasionally clumsy in execution. In Wilson's own words, we have elevated ideals and are dedicated to stability and righteousness. And it is only natural then, as Wilson wrote in justifying the conquest of the Philippines, that our interest must march forward. Altruists though we are, other nations must see to it that they stand off and do not seek to stay us. In the contemporary version, there is a guiding principle that defines the parameters within which the policy debate occurs, a consensus so broad as to exclude only tattered remnants on the right and left, and so authoritative as to be virtually immune to challenge. The principle is America as historical vanguard. History has a discernible direction and destination. Uniquely among all the nations of the world, the United States comprehends and manifests history's purpose. Accordingly, U.S. hegemony is the realization of history's purpose, and what it achieves is for the common good, the merest truism, so that empirical evaluation is unnecessary, if not faintly ridiculous. The primary principle of foreign policy, rooted in Wilsonian idealism and carried over from Clinton to Bush, is the imperative of America's mission as the vanguard of history, transforming the global order and, in doing so, perpetuating its own dominance, guided by the imperative of military supremacy maintained in perpetuity and projected globally. By virtue of its unique comprehension and manifestation of history's purpose, America is entitled, indeed obligated, to act as its leaders determined to be best, for the good of all, whether others understand or not. And like its noble predecessor and current junior partner, Great Britain, America should not be deterred in realizing history's transcendent purpose, even if it is held up to obloquy by the foolish and resentful, as was its predecessor in global rule, according to its most prestigious advocates. To still any qualms that might arise, it suffices to refresh our understanding that Providence summons Americans to the task of reforming global order, the Wilsonian tradition, to which all recent occupants of the Oval Office, regardless of party, have adhered, as have, commonly, their predecessors, their counterparts elsewhere, and their most reviled enemies, with required change of names. But to reassure ourselves that the powerful are motivated by elevated ideals and altruism in the quest of stability and righteousness, we have to adopt the stance called intentional ignorance by a critic of the terrible atrocities in Central America in the 1980s, backed by the political leadership that is again at the helm in Washington. Adopting that stance, not only can we tidy up the past, conceding the inevitable flaws that accompany even the best of intentions, but more recently, since the advent of the new norm of humanitarian intervention, we can even go on to portray U.S. foreign policy as having entered a noble phase with a saintly glow. Washington's post-Cold War interventions were, on the whole, noble, but half-hearted. They were half-hearted because they were noble, historian Michael Mandelbaum assures us. Perhaps we are even too saintly. We must beware of granting idealism a near-exclusive hold on our foreign policy, more sober voices warn, thus neglecting our own legitimate interests in our dedicated service to others. Somehow, Europeans have failed to understand the unique idealism of American leaders. How can this be, since it is the merest truism? Max Boot suggests an answer. Europe has often been driven by avarice, and the cynical Europeans cannot comprehend the strain of idealism that animates U.S. foreign policy. After 200 years, Europe still hasn't figured out what makes America tick. Their ineradicable cynicism leads Europeans to attribute base motives to Washington and to fail to join its noble ventures with sufficient enthusiasm. Another respected historian and political commentator, Robert Kagan, offers a different explanation. Europe's problem is that it is consumed with paranoid conspiratorial anti-Americanism, which has reached a fevered intensity, though fortunately a few figures like Berlusconi and Aznar braved the storm. Unwittingly, no doubt, Boot and Kagan are plagiarizing John Stuart Mill's classic essay on humanitarian intervention, in which he urged Britain to undertake the enterprise vigorously, specifically to conquer more of India. Britain must pursue this high-minded mission, Mill explained, even though it will be held up to obloquy on the continent. Unmentioned was that by doing so, Britain was striking still further devastating blows at India and extending the near monopoly of opium production that it needed, both to force open Chinese markets by violence and to sustain the imperial system more broadly by means of its immense narco-trafficking enterprises, all well known in England at the time. But such matters could not be the source of the obloquy. Rather, Europeans are exciting odium against us, Mill wrote, because they are unable to comprehend that England is truly a novelty in the world, a remarkable nation that acts only in the service of others. It is dedicated to peace, though if the aggressions of barbarians force it to a successful war, it selflessly bears the cost, while the fruits it shares in fraternal equality with the whole human race, including the barbarians it conquers and destroys for their own benefit. England is not only peerless but near perfect, in Mill's view, with no aggressive designs, desiring no benefit to itself at the expense of others. Its policies are blameless and laudable. England was the 19th century counterpart of the idealistic New World bent on ending inhumanity, motivated by pure altruism and uniquely dedicated to the highest principles and values, though also sadly misunderstood by the cynical or perhaps paranoid Europeans. Mill's essay was written as Britain was engaged in some of the worst crimes of its imperial reign. It is hard to think of a more distinguished and truly honorable intellectual, or a more disgraceful example of apologetics for terrible crimes. Such facts might inspire some reflection as Boot and Kagan illustrate Marx's dictum about tragedy replayed as farce. It is also worth recalling that the record of continental imperialism is even worse, and the rhetoric that accompanied it no less glorious, as when France gained Mill's approval by carrying out its civilizing mission in Algeria while exterminating the indigenous population, the French Minister of War declared. Kagan's concept of anti-Americanism, while conventional, also merits reflection. In such pronouncements, the term anti-American and its variants, hating America and the like, are regularly employed to defame critics of state policy who may admire and respect the country, its culture, and its achievements, indeed think it is the greatest place on earth. Nevertheless, they hate America and are anti-American on the tacit assumption that the society and its people are to be identified with the state power. This usage is drawn directly from the lexicon of totalitarianism. In the former Russian Empire, dissidents were guilty of anti-Sovietism. Perhaps critics of Brazil's military dictatorship were labeled anti-Brazilian. Among people with some commitment to freedom and democracy, such attitudes are inconceivable. It would only arouse ridicule in Rome or Milan if a critic of Berlusconi's policies were condemned as anti-Italian, though perhaps it would have passed in Mussolini's day. It is useful to remember that no matter where we turn, there is rarely any shortage of elevated ideals to accompany the resort to violence. The words accompanying the Wilsonian tradition may be stirring in their nobility, but should also be examined in practice, not just rhetoric. For example, Wilson's call for conquest of the Philippines, already mentioned, or as president, his interventions in Haiti and the Dominican Republic that left both countries in ruins, or what Walter Lefebvre calls the Wilsonian corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which dictated that only American oil interests receive concessions within the reach of its power. The same is true of the worst tyrants. In 1990, Saddam Hussein warned Kuwait of possible retribution for actions that were undermining Iraq's battered economy after Iraq had protected Kuwait during the war with Iran. But he assured the world that he wanted not permanent fighting, but permanent peace and a dignified life. In 1938, President Roosevelt's close confidant, Sumner Welles, praised the Munich Agreement with the Nazis and felt that it might lead to a new world order based upon justice and upon law. Shortly after, they carried the project forward by occupying parts of Czechoslovakia, while Hitler explained that they were filled with earnest desire to serve the true interests of the peoples dwelling in this area, to safeguard the national individuality of the German and Czech peoples, and to further the peace and social welfare of all. Mussolini's concerns for the liberated populations of Ethiopia were no less exalted. The same was true of Japan's aims in Manchuria and North China, and its sacrifices to create an earthly paradise for the suffering people and to defend their legitimate governments from communist bandits. What could be more moving than Japan's exalted responsibility to establish a new order in 1938, to ensure the permanent stability of East Asia based on mutual aid of Japan, Manchuria, and China in political, economic, and cultural fields, their joint defense against communism, and their cultural, economic, and social progress. After the war, interventions were routinely declared to be humanitarian or in self-defense and therefore in accord with the UN Charter. For example, Russia's murderous invasion of Hungary in 1956, justified by Soviet lawyers on the grounds that it was undertaken at the invitation of the government of Hungary as a defensive response to foreign funding of subversive activities and armed bands within Hungary for purposes of overthrowing the democratically elected government. Or, with comparable plausibility, the U.S. attack against South Vietnam a few years later, undertaken in collective self-defense against internal aggression by the South Vietnamese and their assault from the inside, Adlai Stevenson and John F. Kennedy, respectively. We need not assume that these protestations are disingenuous, no matter how grotesque they may be. Often one finds the same rhetoric in internal documents where there is no obvious reason to dissemble. For example, the argument by Stalin's diplomats that to create real democracies, some outside pressure would be necessary. We should not hesitate to use this kind of interference into the domestic affairs of other nations, since democratic government is one of the main guarantees of durable peace. Others agree, doubtless with no less sincerity, urging that we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It is better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists. George Kennan, in this case, briefing U.S. ambassadors in Latin America on the need to be guided by a pragmatic concern for the protection of our raw materials, ours, wherever they happen to be located, to which we must preserve our inherent right of access, by conquest if necessary, in accord with the ancient law of nations. It requires a heavy dose of intentional ignorance and loyalty to power to delete from memory the human consequences of instituting and sustaining strong regimes. The same talents are needed to sustain faith in the appeal to national security, invoked to justify the use of force, a pretext that can rarely be upheld for any state on inspection of the historical and documentary record. As these few examples illustrate, even the harshest and most shameful measures are regularly accompanied by profession of noble intent. An honest look would only generalize Thomas Jefferson's observation on the world situation of his day. We believe no more in Bonaparte's fighting merely for the liberties of the seas than in Great Britain's fighting for the liberties of mankind. The object is the same: to draw to themselves the power, the wealth, and the resources of other nations. A century later, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State Robert Lansing, who also appears to have had few illusions about Wilsonian idealism, commented scornfully on how willing the British, French, or Italians are to accept a mandate from the League of Nations, as long as there are mines, oil fields, rich grain fields, or railroads that will make it a profitable undertaking. These unselfish governments declare that mandates must be accepted for the good of mankind. They will do their share by administering the rich regions of Mesopotamia, Syria, etc. The proper assessment of these pretensions is so manifest that it is almost an insult to state it. And manifest indeed it is, when declarations of noble intent are proffered by others. For oneself, different standards apply. One may choose to have selective faith in the domestic political leadership, adopting the stance that Hans Morgenthau, one of the founders of modern international relations theory, condemned as our conformist subservience to those in power, the regular stance of most intellectuals throughout history. But it is important to recognize that profession of noble intent is predictable and therefore carries no information, even in the technical sense of the term. Those who are seriously interested in understanding the world will adopt the same standards, whether they are evaluating their own political and intellectual elites or those of official enemies. One might fairly ask how much would survive this elementary exercise in rationality and honesty. It should be added that there are occasional departures from the common stance of subordination to power on the part of the educated classes. Some of the most important current illustrations are to be found in two countries whose harsh and repressive regimes have been sustained by U.S. military aid, Turkey and Colombia. In Turkey, prominent writers, journalists, academics, and publishers, and others not only protest atrocities and draconian laws, but also carry out regular civil disobedience, facing and sometimes enduring severe and prolonged punishment. In Colombia, courageous priests, academics, human rights and union activists, and others face the constant threat of assassination in one of the world's most violent states. Their actions should elicit humility and shame among their Western counterparts, and would if the truth were not veiled by the intentional ignorance that makes a crucial contribution to ongoing crimes. Chapter 3, The New Era of Enlightenment. The final years of the millennium witnessed a display of exuberant self-adulation that may even have surpassed its none too glorious predecessors, with awed acclaim for the leaders of an idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity, dedicated to principles and values for the first time in history. An era of enlightenment and benevolence was upon us, in which the civilized nations led by the United States, then at the height of its glory, acted out of altruism and moral fervor in pursuit of exalted ideals. Such a shift would be a comforting development indeed. But to join the chorus of self-congratulation, we would need to overlook some recalcitrant facts. The first and most striking is the record of terror and criminal atrocities carried out with the decisive support of the reigning superpower and its allies in very recent years, continuing without noticeable change and suppressed as effectively as in the past within the prevailing intellectual culture, matters of great significance, which do not disappear from actual history merely because that is the preference of its caretakers. Taking a longer view, we would also be compelled to disregard the fact that over the last millennium, war has been the dominant activity of European states, and we would have to put aside the basic reason for that unpleasant reality. The central tragic fact is simple. Coercion works. Those who apply substantial force to their fellows get compliance, and from that compliance draw the multiple advantages of money, goods, deference, and access to pleasures denied to less powerful people. A fact of life understood all too well by most of the people in the world, but a principle of statecraft that has been rescinded, so we are now told, not for the first time. One more immediate way to evaluate the prospects that were hailed with such enthusiasm is to consider the flow of U.S. military aid. A good starting point is the year 1997, when the U.S. foreign policy was lauded for entering a noble phase with a saintly glow, setting the tone for the rhetorical flights that ensued. At the mundane level of fact, 1997 was of some significance for the human rights movement. In that single year, the flow of U.S. arms to Turkey exceeded the combined total of U.S. military aid to Turkey for the entire Cold War period prior to the onset of its counterinsurgency campaign against its miserably repressed Kurdish population. By 1997, the campaign had driven millions of people from the devastated countryside, with tens of thousands killed and every imaginable form of barbaric torture, ranking high among the crimes of the grisly 1990s. As atrocities escalated, Turkey became the leading recipient of U.S. arms worldwide, Israel and Egypt aside, with 80% of its supply coming from Washington. In the same year, U.S. military aid to Colombia began to skyrocket, increasing from $50 million to $290 million 2 years later, and rapidly growing since. By 1999, Colombia had replaced Turkey as the world leader in U.S. military aid. Further militarization of Colombia's internal conflicts, deeply rooted in the awful history of a rich society with extreme poverty and violence, had the predictable consequences for the tortured population and also led guerrilla forces to become yet another army terrorizing the peasantry and, more recently, the urban population as well. The most prominent Colombian human rights organization estimates the number of people forcefully displaced at 2.7 million, increasing by 1,000 a day. They estimate that more than 350,000 people were driven from their homes by violence in the first 9 months of 2002, more than in all of 2001. Political killings were reported to have risen to 20 a day, double the level of 1998. In the case of the leading recipients of U.S. military aid, the reaction is silence, an increased support for the atrocities. Consider, for comparison, the most demonic and dangerous member of the Axis of Evil. The New York Times reports that as many as 1 million people have been relocated inside Iraq, concluding accurately that one element of the misery caused by President Saddam Hussein's rule is the internally displaced population. The article was headlined, "Uprooted Iraqis See War as Path to Lost Homes." There has been no inquiry into whether Kurds and Colombians, uprooted with extreme violence, apparently in even greater numbers, might also see war as a path to lost homes. The proposal would, in fact, be outlandish. Washington could alleviate the misery and perhaps clear the way to a more substantial solution to deeply rooted problems by simply withdrawing its support for atrocities. But that would require, at the very least, a willingness on the part of the educated classes to look into the mirror instead of restricting themselves to lamentations on the crimes of official enemies, about which there is often little that can be done. East Timor and Kosovo. Just as Colombia was replacing Turkey as the leading recipient of U.S. military aid, another tale of horror was unfolding that Washington could easily have brought to a quick end, East Timor. In 1999, Indonesia escalated the atrocities in the territory they had invaded in 1975, killing perhaps 200,000 people with the military and diplomatic support of the U.S. and Britain, assisted by intentional ignorance. In the early months of 1999, Indonesian forces and their paramilitary associates added several thousand more to the death toll. While the ruling generals announced that worse would come if the population voted the wrong way in an August 30 referendum on independence, as they did with amazing courage. The Indonesian military made good on its promise, driving hundreds of thousands from their homes and destroying most of the country. For the first time, the atrocities were well publicized in the United States. On September 8, the Clinton administration reacted by reiterating its position that East Timor is the responsibility of the government of Indonesia, and we don't want to take that responsibility away from them. A few days later, under strong international and domestic pressure, Clinton reversed the 25-year policy of support for Indonesia's crimes in East Timor and informed the Indonesian military that Washington would no longer directly support their crimes. They immediately withdrew from the territory, allowing an Australian-led UN peacekeeping force to enter unopposed. The lesson was crystal clear, as a handful of activists and critics had been saying for almost 25 years. There had never been any need for threats or forceful measures. It would have sufficed to withdraw from participation for some of the worst crimes of the late 20th century to have come to a halt. But that was not the lesson that was drawn. Instead, the doctrinal system, rising to the challenge, drew the required conclusion. The events in East Timor demonstrated that foreign policy had entered into a noble phase, as the leaders of the civilized West pursued their dedication to principles and values. That recasting is an impressive achievement. One wonders whether it would be possible to contrive a hypothetical series of events that could not be adapted to prove the required thesis. East Timor was offered as a crucial example of the era of enlightenment, with its new norms of humanitarian intervention. There was no intervention, let alone humanitarian intervention. Those who were at the height of their glory were still persisting in their decades-old participation in Indonesia's crimes just at the moment when these accolades appeared. The prime illustration of the new era, however, was Kosovo, where the U.S. and its allies acted out of altruism and moral fervor alone, forging a new kind of approach to the use of power in world politics as they reacted to the deportation of more than a million Kosovars from their homeland by bombing so as to save them from horrors of suffering or from death. This description, from a scholarly source, is the standard version. Accounts in the media, journals of opinion, and scholarship rarely depart from it. To select some typical examples, we read that after violence surged in Kosovo in 1998, Serb forces responded with an ethnic cleansing campaign and drove more than half the Albanian population into exile. The growing bloodshed led the U.S. and its allies to launch a massive bombing campaign, allowing Albanian refugees to return. In the spring of 1999, Serbs appeared to be conducting an ethnic cleansing campaign. Albanian Kosovars fled the assault, recounting stories of summary executions and forced expulsions when they reached their neighboring countries. And these expulsions and atrocities elicited the NATO bombing campaign on March 24th. Hence, the intervention in Kosovo was purely for the benefit of the people of the region, an act of altruism, like all U.S. interventions in the region. It was absolutely right, Timothy Garton Ash concludes, because it passed the very high threshold for such humanitarian intervention, something approaching genocide by the killing or ethnic cleansing of large numbers of its people by the Serbian government. Surely this establishes the case and justifies the praise for the altruistic leaders, opening a new era of enlightenment. And so it might, if the claims had any relation to the facts. The small sample of quotes presented above is typical in several interesting respects. First, the accounts are given without any evidence, though an enormous amount was available from impeccable Western sources. Second, the standard picture reverses the order of events. Uncontroversially, the bombing preceded the ethnic cleansing and atrocities, which were, in fact, its anticipated consequence. Kosovo was an ugly place before the NATO bombing, with an estimated 2,000 killed on all sides during the preceding year. However, the rich Western documentary record reveals no changes of significance until the March 24th bombing began, apart from a slight increase in Serbian atrocities 2 days earlier, when monitors were withdrawn in anticipation of the NATO attack. The UN began registering refugees a week later. These basic facts were well known by May 1999, when the Milosevic indictment was presented. It detailed a series of terrible crimes, which had, however, virtually without exception, taken place after the bombing. On March 24th, as the bombing began, British Defense Minister George Robertson, later NATO Secretary General, testified before the House of Commons that until mid-January 1999, the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA, was responsible for more deaths in Kosovo than the Serbian authorities had been. He was referring to the Albanian guerrillas, by then CIA-backed, who had explained frankly that their goal was to kill Serbs so as to elicit a harsh reaction that would lead to public support in the West for NATO intervention. A subsequent parliamentary inquiry revealed that Foreign Secretary Robin Cook had told the House on January 18th that the KLA had committed more breaches of the ceasefire and until this weekend was responsible for more deaths than the Yugoslav security forces. Robertson and Cook are specifically referring to a massacre carried out by the security forces at Recek on January 15th, in which 45 people were reported killed. But since Western documentation reveals no notable change in the distribution of violence after Recek, their conclusions, if valid in mid-January, essentially remained so in late March. It was clear at the time that such massacres were of no concern to the US or UK leadership. Thus, the Laquitia massacre in East Timor shortly after was apparently far worse, was only one of many, and had no pretext for self-defense. Still, this and other massacres led to no change in US-UK support for the Indonesian invaders. Putting aside such selective concerns, however, the voluminous Western evidence does not reveal any significant shift in Kosovo before the bombing. Serious scholarship reaches similar conclusions. Nicholas Wheeler, who does not invert the chronology, estimates that Serbs had killed 500 Albanians before the NATO bombing, implying that 1,500 had been killed by the KLA. Nevertheless, he concludes that bombing Serbia was a genuine case of humanitarian intervention because, though only a few hundred Albanians were killed prior to the bombing, intelligence points to this as a precursor to a major campaign of killing and ethnic cleansing. Again, no credible sources are provided. This is one of the few serious attempts to provide any justification for the NATO bombing apart from the inverted chronology. On March 27th, 3 days after the bombing of Serbia began, NATO Commander Wesley Clark informed the press that the vicious Serbian reaction was entirely predictable. He added that it had been fully anticipated and was not in any way a concern of the political leadership. In his memoirs, Clark reports that on March 6th, he had informed Secretary of State Madeleine Albright that if NATO proceeded to bomb Serbia, almost certainly the Serbs would attack the civilian population, and NATO would be able to do nothing to prevent that reaction on the ground. Reviewing Clark's book, Michael Ignatieff recognizes that, according to the NATO commander, the really decisive impulse propelling the NATO bombing campaign was not Milosevic's human rights violations in Kosovo before March 1999. Nor was it his wholesale eviction after the bombing began. What mattered most was the need to impose NATO's will on a leader whose defiance, first in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, was undermining the credibility of American and European diplomacy and of NATO's willpower. That the primary concern was the credibility of the masters had already been made clear by Clinton and Blair. The point was reiterated in Defense Secretary William Cohen's subsequent report to Congress, once the usual chronological falsifications are disregarded, and it is confirmed by Clark's memoirs. Andrew Basevich gives an even more cynical interpretation, dismissing all humanitarian motives. Clinton's resort to force in Bosnia in 1995 and his bombing of Serbia in 1999 were not, as claimed, to put a stop to ethnic cleansing or in response to claims of conscience, but to preempt threats to the cohesion of NATO and the credibility of American power. The plight of the Kosovars, he alleges, was not a concern. The intent of the NATO bombing was to provide an object lesson to any European state fancying that it was exempt from the rules of the post-Cold War era established by Washington. What counted was affirming the dominant position of the United States in a Europe that was unified, integrated, and open. From the outset, the war's architects understood that its purpose had been to sustain American primacy in Europe and to forestall the intolerable prospect of Europe's backsliding, presumably out of U.S. control. 4 years later, Europe and the U.S. had lost interest. Half of the Kosovars live in poverty. Radical Islamists have capitalized on the ill feelings produced by the international community's negligent behavior, monopolizing the distribution of food, clothing, and shelter, as well as the tools for the cultural survival of those in rural areas, giving rise to a Taliban phenomenon. Post-war Western policies may prove to be directly responsible for the production of Europe's own Taliban. Kosovo and East Timor are conventionally offered not only as the prime illustration of the new era of humanitarian intervention, but also as a demonstration of how new norms are evolving toward a redefined role for the United Nations. The norms that Western powers established in these two cases render the UN Charter obsolete. With these norms established, it becomes legitimate to invade a country without Security Council authorization. As approvingly noted by the Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, that is the lesson that the United Nations and all of us should draw from the invasion of Iraq, firmly grounded in the new norms. The record suggests that we should draw rather different lessons about how norms are established by the powerful to provide justification for their claimed sovereign right to take military action at will, Colin Powell, and how even very recent history can be reconstructed by well-functioning doctrinal systems. These are the crucial lessons, and those concerned with the future would be well advised to take them seriously. The need for colonization. As the tragedies of East Timor and Kosovo unfolded in 1999, Turkey relinquished to Colombia its place as leading recipient of U.S. arms. The reason is not hard to discern. Turkish state terror was by then a success. Colombia's was not. Throughout the 1990s and the new era of enlightenment, Colombia had by far the worst human rights record in the Western Hemisphere, and was at the same time by far the hemisphere's leading recipient of U.S. arms and military training, a correlation that is well established and would be of no slight concern if it were known outside of scholarship and dissident circles. Atrocities in Colombia include displacement of the population through chemical warfare, called fumigation, under the guise of a drug war that is hard to take seriously. One of the leading academic authorities notes that a provocative case can be made that U.S. drug policy contributes effectively to the control of an ethnically distinct and economically deprived underclass at home and serves U.S. economic and security interests abroad. Many criminologists and observers of the international scene regard that as a considerable understatement. The analysis helps explain why the U.S.-sponsored actions are carried out with ever greater enthusiasm and zeal, even as they increasingly fail to achieve the alleged goal of dealing with domestic drug use, and why measures that are known to be far more effective, specifically prevention and treatment, are scarcely funded. The governors of Colombia's targeted southern provinces, along with peasants and human rights activists, have proposed plans relying on manual eradication of coca and poppies and support for alternative crops, but to little effect. Meanwhile, the land is poisoned by fumigation, children die, and the uprooted and scattered victims suffer from sickness and injury. Peasant agriculture is based on a rich tradition of knowledge and experience gained over many centuries, commonly passed on from mother to daughter. Though a remarkable human achievement, it is very fragile and can be destroyed forever in a single generation. It is being destroyed, and along with it, some of the richest biodiversity in the world. Campesinos, indigenous people, and Afro-Colombians are now joining the millions in rotting slums and camps. And with the people gone, multinationals can strip the mountains for coal, extract oil and other resources, and probably convert what is left of the land to ranching by the rich or agro-export in an environment shorn of its treasures and variety. Informed analysts and observers describe Washington's fumigation programs as another stage in the historical process of driving poor peasants from the land for the benefit of foreign investors and Colombian elites. Like many other centers of turmoil and state terror, Colombia is part of an important oil-producing region and a significant producer itself. Much the same is true of Chechnya, Western China, the Central Asian dictatorships, and other places where state violence was intensified after 9/11 on the pretext of a war on terror, and with the expectation that there would be a nod from Washington. Human rights organizations and the State Department agree that the overwhelming majority of atrocities in Colombia can be attributed to the military and paramilitaries, the 6th Division of the 5-Division Colombian Army, because of their close links, according to Human Rights Watch. The proportion of atrocities attributed to the paramilitaries has been increasing as crimes are privatized in accord with neoliberal practice, a familiar development elsewhere as well. Serbia used private militias in the former Yugoslavia, as did Indonesia in East Timor, and Turkey in the southeast, and many other places. There is a corresponding privatization of international atrocities. Fumigation is being taken over by private companies consisting of U.S. military officers under contract to the Pentagon, also a pattern that is worldwide and useful for evading accountability. Even if one were to give credence to the U.S. arguments in favor of the drug war, the underlying assumptions are scandalous. Imagine the reaction to a proposal that Colombia or China should undertake fumigation programs in North Carolina to destroy government-subsidized crops used for more lethal products, which, furthermore, they not only must import at risk of trade sanctions, but for which they must allow advertising aimed at vulnerable populations. There is a new and highly regarded literary genre inquiring into the cultural defects that keep us from responding properly to the crimes of others. An interesting question, no doubt, though by any reasonable standard it ranks well below a different one. Why do we persist in our own crimes, either directly or through crucial support for murderous clients? It is instructive to ask how often or how accurately one finds reference to Turkey, Colombia, East Timor, and many similar examples in the contemporary literature on flaws in our character. There is much self-congratulation about the new ruling ideology in the moral universe of the enlightened states, grounded in the principle that all states have a responsibility to protect their citizens. If their leaders are unable or unwilling to do so, they render their countries liable to military intervention, authorized by the Security Council, or failing that, as in the case of Kosovo, by individual countries in conscience-shocking situations. Atrocities comparable to, or much worse than, anything charged to Milosevic in Kosovo before the NATO bombing were not conscience-shocking when responsibility traced back home, as it often did, and even when the crimes took place within, not just near, the borders of NATO. In the case of Turkey, conscience-shocking situations went virtually unheeded in the United States until the moment in early 2003 when the Turkish government defied Washington's demands and followed the wishes of 95% of its population by refusing to allow an attack on Iraq from its borders. At that point, one began to read about Turkey's ghastly record of torturing, killing, and disappearing Turkish Kurds and destroying more than 3,000 of their villages, with citations from human rights organizations reiterating what they had reported in far more detail years before while the crimes were in progress, thanks to U.S. aid, and could easily have been stopped. To this day, the decisive U.S. role remains under wraps. As before, the most that can be said is that we tolerated the abuses suffered by the Kurds. Massive contribution to major atrocities is not toleration. The time to expose the suffering of the Kurds is while Washington is providing the means to carry out the crimes that are found shocking in retrospect, with responsibility safely displaced far away. Such performances, which are routine, would be deplored among official enemies. Their easy acceptance in the most powerful state in history, again, does not bode well for the future. Another currently fashionable formulation of the mission of the enlightened states holds that the need for colonization is as great as it ever was in the 19th century, to bring to the rest of the world the principles of order, freedom, and justice to which postmodern societies are dedicated, the version offered by Tony Blair's key foreign policy advisor, Robert Cooper. He did not elaborate on the need for colonization in the 19th century and the consequences as that obligation was shouldered by Britain, France, Belgium, and other standard bearers of Western civilization, but an honest look at the real world may well support his judgment that the need for colonization is as compelling now as it was in the days Cooper recalls with nostalgia. To rephrase, we can learn a good deal about today's enlightened states by paying a little attention to their record and how they portrayed it, both as events were unfolding and in historical retrospect. We should not, however, overlook the changes in world order that have occurred since World War II. One of these, Robert Jervis calls a change of spectacular proportions, perhaps the single most striking discontinuity that the history of international politics has anywhere provided, that the states of Europe now live in peace, and, some argue more controversially, democracies do not go to war with one another. It is this striking discontinuity to which Cooper alludes in joining those who hail the birth of a postmodern world system of law, justice, and civility, though the West must revert to rougher methods of an earlier era. Force, preemptive attack, deception, whatever is necessary, when it comes to dealing with those who still live in the 19th century world of every state for itself. The West must revert to the laws of the jungle when we are operating in the jungle, exactly as it has done in the disgraceful past.
Protecting naughty children from infection. The enlightened states of the late 19th century were not the first to laud themselves for liberating barbarians from their sad fate by violence, destruction, and plunder. They were drawing from a rich tradition of distinguished leaders, who were troubled by the rising flood of evil doctrines and pernicious examples, and asked, "What would become of our religious and political institutions, of the moral force of our governments, and of that conservative system which has saved us from complete dissolution, if the contagion and the invasion of vicious principles is not deterred or overcome?" In expressing these concerns, the Tsar and Metternich were referring to the pernicious doctrines of republicanism and popular self-rule spread by the apostles of sedition in the New World. In the rhetoric of contemporary planners, a rotten apple that might spoil the barrel, a domino that might topple others. The contagion of these doctrines, they warned, crosses the seas and often appears with all the symptoms of destruction which characterize it, in places where not even any direct contact, any relation of proximity, might give ground for apprehension. Worse yet, the apostles of sedition had just announced their intention to expand their dominion by proclaiming the Monroe Doctrine, a species of arrogance particularly American and inexcusable, as Bismarck later described it. Bismarck did not have to await the era of Wilsonian idealism to learn the meaning of the Monroe Doctrine, explained by Secretary of State Robert Lansing to President Wilson, who found his description unanswerable, though advising it would be impolitic to let it reach the public. In its advocacy of the Monroe Doctrine, the United States considers its own interests. The integrity of other American nations is an incident, not an end. While this may seem based on selfishness alone, the author of the doctrine had no higher or more generous motive in its declaration. The doctrine could not yet be implemented fully because of the balance of world power, though Wilson did secure U.S. domination of the Caribbean region by force, leaving a terrible legacy that remains to this day, and was able to move somewhat beyond, driving the British enemy out of oil-rich Venezuela and supporting the vicious and corrupt dictator Juan Vicente Gomez, who opened the country to U.S. corporations. Open-door free trade policies were instituted in the usual way, by pressuring Venezuela to bar British concessions while continuing to demand and secure U.S. oil rights in the Middle East, where the British and French were in the lead. By 1928, Venezuela had become the world's leading oil exporter, with U.S. companies in charge. The story continues right to the front pages of 2003, with enormous poverty in a country of rich resources and potential, yielding great wealth to foreign investors and a small sector of the population. The reach of U.S. power was still limited in Wilson's time, but as President William Howard Taft had presciently observed, the day is not far distant when the whole hemisphere will be ours, in fact, as, by virtue of our superiority of race, it already is ours morally. Latin Americans may not understand, the Wilson administration added, but that is because they are naughty children who are exercising all the privileges and rights of grown-ups and require a stiff hand, an authoritative hand. More gentle means should not be overlooked, however. It may be useful to pat them a little bit and make them think that you are fond of them, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles advised President Eisenhower. There are naughty children everywhere. Wilson regarded Filipinos as children who must obey as those who are in tutelage, at least those who survived the liberation he had called for while extolling his altruism. His State Department also regarded Italians as like children who must be led and assisted more than almost any other nation. It was therefore right and proper for his successors to offer enthusiastic support for the fine young revolution of Mussolini's fascism that crushed the threat of democracy among Italians who hunger for strong leadership and enjoy being dramatically governed. The conception remained in place through the 1930s and was revived immediately after the war. As the U.S. undertook to subvert Italian democracy in 1948 by withholding food from starving people, restoring the fascist police, and threatening worse, the State Department's Italian desk officer explained that policies must be designed so that even the dumbest WOP would sense the drift. Haitians were little more than primitive savages, according to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who claimed to have rewritten the Haitian Constitution during Wilson's military occupation, so as to permit U.S. corporations to take over Haiti's land and resources after its recalcitrant parliament had been sent packing by the Marines. When the Eisenhower administration was seeking to overthrow the newly established Castro government in Cuba in 1959, CIA chief Allen Dulles complained that there was in Cuba no opposition to Castro who were capable of action, in part because in these primitive countries where the sun shone, the demands of the people were far less than in the more advanced societies, so they were unaware of how much they were suffering. The need for discipline has been reiterated forcefully over the years. To mention another case of contemporary relevance, when Iran's conservative parliamentary government sought to gain control of its own resources,
the U.S. and Britain instigated a military coup to install an obedient regime that ruled with terror for 25 years. The coup sent a more far-reaching message, spelled out by the editors of the New York Times. Underdeveloped countries, with rich resources, now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their number which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism. Iran's experience may strengthen the hands of more reasonable and more far-seeing leaders elsewhere, who will have a clear-eyed understanding of the principles of decent behavior. The same lesson had been taught nearer home, at the Chapultepec Conference in Mexico in February 1945, that laid the basis for the post-war order now that the Monroe Doctrine could be enforced in the Wilsonian sense. Latin Americans were then under the influence of what the State Department called the philosophy of the new nationalism, which embraces policies designed to bring about a broader distribution of wealth and to raise the standard of living of the masses. Washington was concerned that economic nationalism is the common denominator of the new aspirations for industrialization, just as it had been for England, the United States, and in fact every other country that succeeded in industrializing. Latin Americans are convinced that the first beneficiaries of the development of a country's resources should be the people of that country. That was unacceptable. The first beneficiaries must be U.S. investors, while Latin America fulfills its service function. The U.S. therefore imposed an economic charter for the Americas, designed to eliminate economic nationalism in all its forms. With an exception, however, economic nationalism remained a crucial feature of the U.S. economy, which relied far more than in the past on a dynamic state sector, often operating under the cover of defense. It is useful to recall that even at the peak of the Cold War, more perceptive observers understood that the primary threat posed by communism was the economic transformation of the communist countries in ways that reduced their willingness and ability to complement the industrial economies of the West. Another version of the philosophy of the new nationalism, in this case dating from 1917. The same concerns account for the persistence into the post-war period of the analytical framework American policymakers had developed and employed during the interwar years for relations with right-wing dictatorships of European fascism, historian David Schmitz notes. The point has been to control the threat of communism, understood not as a military threat, but very much in the terms just described. The analytical framework of relations with the fascist states is eminently worth recalling, if only because it has reappeared with such consistency right to the present, and therefore can teach us a good deal about the world that has been shaped in no small measure by the most powerful states and the private institutions that are their tools and tyrants, to borrow the words of James Madison when he contemplated, with much unease, the fate of the democratic experiment of which he was the leading framer. The rise of fascism in the interwar period elicited concern, but was generally regarded rather favorably by the U.S. and British governments, the business world, and a good deal of elite opinion. The reason was that the fascist version of extreme nationalism permitted extensive Western economic penetration and also destroyed the much-feared labor movements and the left and the excessive democracy in which they could function. Support for Mussolini was effusive. Across a broad range of opinion, that admirable Italian gentleman, as President Roosevelt described him in 1933, enjoyed great respect until World War II broke out. Support extended to Hitler's Germany as well. It is, incidentally, well to bear in mind that the most monstrous regime in history came to power in the country that, by reasonable measures, represented the highest peak of Western civilization in the sciences and the arts, and had been considered a model of democracy before international conflict took forms that could not accommodate this conception, and, rather like Saddam Hussein, half a century later, retained substantial Anglo-American support until Hitler launched direct aggression that infringed too seriously on U.S. and U.K. interests. Support for fascism began at once, praising the fascist takeover in Italy, which quickly destroyed the parliamentary system and violently suppressed labor and political opposition. Ambassador Henry Fletcher articulated the assumptions that were to guide U.S. policy there and elsewhere in years to come. Italy faced a stark choice, he wrote the Secretary of State. Either Mussolini and fascism, or Giolitti and socialism. Giolitti was a leading figure of Italian liberalism. A decade later, in 1937, the State Department continued to regard European fascism as a moderate force that must succeed or the masses, this time reinforced by the disillusioned middle classes, will again turn to the left. That same year, U.S. Ambassador to Italy, William Phillips, was greatly impressed by the efforts of Mussolini to improve the conditions of the masses and found much evidence in favor of the fascist view that they represent a true democracy, inasmuch as the welfare of the people is their principal objective. He considered Mussolini's accomplishments astounding, and a source of constant amazement, and enthusiastically praised his great human qualities. The State Department vigorously concurred, also lauding Mussolini's magnificent achievements in Ethiopia and hailing fascism for having brought order out of chaos, discipline out of license, and solvency out of bankruptcy. In 1939, FDR continued to regard Italian fascism as of great importance to the world, though still in the experimental stage. In 1938, FDR and his close confidant Sumner Wells approved of Hitler's Munich settlement, which dismembered Czechoslovakia. As noted earlier, Wells felt that it presented the opportunity for the establishment by the nations of the world of a new world order based upon justice and upon law, in which the Nazi moderates would play a leading role. In April 1941, George Kennan wrote from his consular post in Berlin that German leaders have no wish to see other people suffer under German rule, are most anxious that their new subjects should be happy in their care, and are making important compromises to assure this benign outcome. The business world, too, was highly enthusiastic about European fascism. Investment boomed in fascist Italy. The WOPs are unwopping themselves, Fortune magazine declared in 1934. After the rise of Hitler, investment boomed in Germany for similar reasons. A stable climate had been established for business operations, with the threat of the masses contained. Until war broke out in 1939, Scott Newton writes, Britain was even more supportive of Hitler, for reasons deeply rooted in Anglo-German industrial, commercial, and financial relations, and a policy of self-preservation for the British establishment in the face of rising popular democratic pressures. Even after the U.S. entered the war, attitudes remained ambivalent. By 1943, the U.S. and Britain had begun their efforts, which intensified after the war, to dismantle the anti-fascist resistance worldwide and restore something like the traditional order, often rewarding some of the worst war criminals with prominent roles. Reviewing the record, Schmitz points out that the ideological basis and fundamental assumptions of American policy remained remarkably consistent through the rest of the century. The Cold War demanded new approaches and tactics, but otherwise left interwar priorities unchanged. The analytical framework, Schmitz illustrates in detail, has persisted until the present, leaving immense suffering and devastation. Throughout, policy planners have faced the agonizing problem of how to reconcile a formal commitment to democracy and freedom with the overriding fact that the United States may often need to do terrible things to get what it has always wanted, Alan Tonelson observes. What the U.S. wanted was economic policies that would enable American business to operate as freely as possible and often as monopolistically as possible, with the aim of creating an integrated United States-dominated capitalist world economy. Still more ominous than the philosophy of the new nationalism was the threat that it could become a virus that might infect others, not by conquest, but by example. That was understood from the earliest days. Secretary of State Lansing warned President Wilson that the Bolshevik disease might spread, a very real danger in view of the process of social unrest throughout the world. Wilson was particularly concerned that the American Negro soldiers returning from abroad might be infected by the example of the soldiers and workers' councils that were being set up in Germany as the war ended, establishing a form of democracy that was as intolerable to the West as it was to Lenin and Trotsky. Similar fears were expressed by Lloyd George's government in Britain, which found hostility to capitalism to be widespread among the working people of England, who were paying close attention to the popular councils that developed in Russia before the Bolshevik takeover destroyed them. Counter-revolutionary violence that did not alleviate elite concerns in the West. Within the United States, social unrest was largely suppressed by Wilson's Red Scare, though only temporarily. Business leaders remained alert to the hazard facing industrialists, with the newly realized political power of the masses and the constant need for shaping public opinion if we are to avoid disaster. Concern over Soviet economic development and its demonstration effect persisted into the 1960s, when the Soviet economy began to stagnate, in large measure because of the escalating arms race that Soviet Premier Khrushchev had sought desperately to prevent. The Cold War itself, from its origins in 1917, was, in significant respects, a North-South conflict writ large. Russia had been Europe's original Third World, declining relative to the West up to World War I, while serving the standard function of providing resources, markets, and investment opportunities. Russia was a special case because of its scale and military power, a factor of growing importance after it played the leading role in defeating Nazi Germany and achieved superpower status in the military dimension. But the primary threats remained as they have been throughout the non-Western world, independent nationalism and the virus effect. On these grounds, it is possible to explain the logical illogicality noted by the War Department in 1945, when it prepared plans for the U.S. to take control of most of the world and surround Russia with military force while denying the adversary any comparable rights. The illogicality they perceived dissolves as soon as we realize that the Soviet Union might have flirted with the thought of associating itself with a rising tide all over the world, wherein the common man aspires to higher and wider horizons. The plans were therefore logical and necessary, however illogical they may appear on the surface. Leading scholars basically agree. John Lewis Gaddis realistically traces the Russia-U.S. conflict back to 1917 and explains that the immediate Western invasion was a justified act of self-defense. It was undertaken in response to a profound and potentially far-reaching intervention by the new Soviet government in the internal affairs not just of the West, but of virtually every country in the world, namely, the revolution's challenge to the very survival of the capitalist order. Change in the social order in Russia, and the possibility that Russian development might infect others, therefore justified the invasion of Russia. Attack is therefore defense, another logical illogicality that becomes coherent once the doctrinal apparatus is properly understood. On the same grounds, we can understand the persistence of basic policies of the U.S. and other leading Western powers before, during, and after the Cold War, always in self-defense. Note that the defensive invasion of Russia in 1918 is another precursor for the doctrine of preventive war declared in September 2002 by radical nationalists pursuing their imperial vision. Let's return to the striking discontinuity in international politics at the end of World War II. One element is that the U.S. became a global actor for the first time, displacing its European rivals and using its incomparable wealth and power to organize the world system with care and skill. What Robert Jervis had in mind, however, is the democratic peace. For centuries, Europeans had devoted themselves to slaughtering one another, meanwhile conquering most of the world. By 1945, they realized that the game was over. The next time it was played would be the last. Western powers can still resort to violence against the weak and defenseless, but not against one another. The Cold War superpower conflict, too, kept to that understanding, though not without extreme hazard. The standard interpretation is different. The democratic peace reflects some happy combination of liberal norms and institutions, such as representative democracy and market economies. Though these factors are real enough, their contribution to the striking discontinuity cannot be properly assessed without due attention to the realization that Western civilization was on the verge of self-annihilation, thanks to the rational pursuit of its traditional practices. Now Europe is internally at peace, just as North America has been since the native population was virtually annihilated, half of Mexico conquered, the U.S.-Canada border established, and the phrase United States transformed from plural to singular 150 years ago. On a global scale, however, the practices, institutions, and dominant culture remain largely unchanged. The portents cannot be lightly dismissed. Chapter 4. Dangerous Times. Concern about current threats is widespread and realistic. In February 2002, the famous doomsday clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists was advanced 2 minutes toward midnight, even before the release of the Bush administration's National Security Strategy and Nuclear Posture Review, which elicited shudders worldwide. With different threats in mind, strategic analyst Michael Crepon regarded the final days of 2002 as the most dangerous time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. A high-level task force concluded that we are entering a time of especially grave danger as we are preparing to attack a ruthless adversary, Iraq, who may well have access to weapons of mass destruction. Such dangers are likely to become even more grave in the longer term as a consequence of the easy resort to violence, as many have pointed out. The reasons behind these concerns merit close attention, but too narrow a focus can be misleading. We can gain a more realistic perspective on them by asking why the Cuban Missile Crisis was such a dangerous time. The answer bears directly on the perils ahead. One word away from nuclear war. The missile crisis was the most dangerous moment in human history, Arthur Schlesinger commented in October 2002 at a conference in Havana on the 40th anniversary of the crisis, attended by a number of those who witnessed it from within as it unfolded. Decision makers at the time undoubtedly understood that the fate of the world was in their hands. Nevertheless, attendees at the conference may have been shocked by some of the revelations. They were informed that in October 1962, the world was one word away from nuclear war. A guy named Arkhipov saved the world, said Thomas Blanton of the National Security Archive in Washington, which helped organize the event. He was referring to Vasily Arkhipov, a Soviet submarine officer who blocked an order to fire nuclear-armed torpedoes on October 27th, at the tensest moment of the crisis, when the submarines were under attack by U.S. destroyers. A devastating response would have been a near certainty, leading to a major war. Participants in the decisions at the time, and at the retrospective 40 years later, did not have to be reminded of President Eisenhower's warning that a major war would destroy the Northern Hemisphere. The parallel between Kennedy's handling of the crisis and President Bush's deliberations over Iraq was a recurrent theme at the meeting. The press reported with many participants accusing Bush of ignoring history, saying they had come to make sure it does not happen again and to offer lessons for today's crises, most notably President George W. Bush's deliberations about whether to strike Iraq. Schlesinger was surely not the only one to bring up the fact that Kennedy chose quarantine as an alternative to military action, while Bush is committed to military action. Nor, presumably, was he the only one to have been taken aback to learn just how close the world came to destruction, even under the less aggressive choice. In his authoritative account of the missile crisis, Raymond Gartoff observes that in the United States there was almost universal approbation for President Kennedy's handling of the crisis. That's a fair assessment, though whether the approval is warranted is a separate question. The confrontation finally came down to two basic issues. One, would Kennedy pledge that the U.S. would not invade Cuba? And two, would he make a public announcement that the U.S. would withdraw its Jupiter nuclear missiles from Turkey on the border of Russia and aimed at its heartland? On both issues, Kennedy ultimately refused. He agreed only to a secret commitment to withdraw the missiles, which had in any case already been scheduled to be replaced by Polaris nuclear submarines. He refused to make any formal commitment not to invade Cuba. Rather, he continued to conduct an active policy of seeking to undermine and displace the Castro regime, including covert operations against Cuba, Gartoff observes. In a highly provocative gesture, as the crisis intensified, the missiles were turned over to Turkish command with ceremonial fanfare on October 22nd. Gartoff comments, "The event was certainly noted in Moscow, but not in Washington. There it was presumably regarded as just another exercise of logical illogicality." As history is crafted by the powerful, the most dramatic moment of the missile crisis was provided by UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson at the Security Council on October 25th, when he exposed Soviet deception by unveiling a photograph of a missile site in Cuba taken by U.S. spy planes. The concept Stevenson moment has entered into historical memory in celebration of this victory over a vicious foe aiming to destroy us. As an intellectual exercise, let's imagine how the Stevenson moment might be viewed by a hypothetical extraterrestrial observer. Call him Martian, and assume that he is free from earthly systems of doctrine and ideology. Martian would surely note that there is no Khrushchev moment in history, no moment at which Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev or his UN ambassador dramatically unveiled photographs of the Jupiter missiles placed in Turkey in 1961 and 62, or of the provocative transfer of the missiles to the Turkish military with ceremonial fanfare, just as the most dangerous moment in human history approached. Reflecting on this distinction, Martians should recall that the Jupiter missiles were only a small element of a far greater threat to Russia, and that Russia had repeatedly been invaded and almost destroyed in the preceding half century, twice by newly rearmed Germany, its richer western part now within a hostile military alliance led by the world's mightiest superpower, once in 1918 by Britain, the U.S., and their allies. He might observe that there was, of course, no Russian threat to invade Turkey, nor any large-scale Russian terrorist campaign or economic warfare against Turkey, nor even a lesser counterpart to the crimes that the Kennedy administration was carrying out against Cuba at the time. Despite all this, only the Stevenson moment exists in historical memory. Martian would surely grasp how the distinction reflects the balance of global power. He would also presumably recall a principle that must be close to a historical universal of intellectual culture. We are good, whoever we happen to be, and they are evil if they stand in our way. Therefore, the radical asymmetry makes perfect sense within the framework of established doctrine. The contours of the asymmetry become even sharper when we consider the occasional effort at extenuation. The crime of the Russians in Cuba was stealth, while the U.S. surrounded Russia with lethal offensive weapons quite openly. That is true. The world ruler not only has no need to conceal its intent, but prefers to advertise it to maintain credibility. The subordination of the ideological system to power ensures that virtually any action, international terrorism, as in Cuba, overt aggression, as in South Vietnam at the same time, participation in mass slaughter to destroy the only mass-based political party, as in South Vietnam and Indonesia, and many others, will either be dispatched to oblivion or reshaped into an act of legitimate self-defense or an act of benevolence that perhaps went astray. The importance of owning a properly crafted history was revealed once again in February 2003, when Colin Powell addressed the UN Security Council, informing its members that the U.S. would go to war with or without UN authorization. The question pondered by commentators was whether Powell would be able to provide a Stevenson moment. Some thought he had. New York Times columnist William Sapphire triumphantly reported Powell's Adlai Stevenson moment, a satellite image of trucks next to a bunker allegedly storing chemical weapons, then another with the trucks gone, clear proof that Iraq had deceived the inspectors by removing the illegal weapons before they arrived, and that the devious Iraqis had penetrated the inspection team, confirming the U.S. thesis that the team was unreliable and hence could not be provided with intelligence data that Washington claimed to have. It was later conceded, with Powell's silent nod of agreement, that for a range of reasons, the time lapse between the taking of the photos, the uncertain use of the site in question, the photographs proved nothing, one of a series of similar cases, which later became a torrent. Still, this was deemed a Stevenson moment, though Adam Clymer pointed out that there was a stark difference between the two. Stevenson's moment was one of real fear about Soviet missiles, of imminent nuclear confrontation. Apparently, there could have been no fear anywhere about missiles on the Russian border. Stevenson's son felt that the differences were even starker. His father had presented the Security Council with proof that a nuclear superpower was installing missiles in Cuba and threatening to upset the world's balance of terror, or, from Martian's standpoint, threatening to shift the world's balance of terror to be a little less extreme in Washington's favor. And, he continued, that moment had an obvious purpose, containing the Soviet Union and maintaining peace. In Martian translation, the Stevenson moment did contribute to a partial containment, but of Washington, not the USSR. A possible invasion of Cuba was averted, though Washington's international terrorist campaign and economic warfare were resumed at once, and the threat to Russia was escalated, all of which takes on greater significance against the background of superpower interchanges at the time, to which we return. Kennedy had no doubts about the threat of the Russian missiles in Cuba. Meeting with his high-level advisors, known as EXCOM, he said, "It's just as if we suddenly began to put a major number of medium-range ballistic missiles in Turkey. Now that'd be goddamn dangerous." His national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, responded, "Well, we did, Mr. President." Surprised, JFK said, "But that was 5 years ago." Actually, 1 year ago, during his administration. He later expressed concern that if the facts were known, his decision to risk war rather than agree publicly to joint withdrawal of missiles from Cuba and Turkey would not play well in Peoria. He feared most people would consider it a very fair trade. Whatever one's judgment about the actions of Khrushchev and Kennedy, there should be universal agreement that Khrushchev's decision to dispatch the missiles to Cuba was an act of criminal lunacy in the light of the possible consequences. It would pass beyond lunacy to condemn those who warned of the dangers and criticized Khrushchev bitterly for proceeding despite the risks. It is the merest truism that choices are assessed in terms of the range of likely consequences. We understand the truism very well when considering the actions of official enemies, but find it hard to apply to ourselves. There are many illustrations, including recent U.S. military exercises. Aid agencies, scholars, and others who properly warned of the risks in Afghanistan and Iraq were ridiculed when the worst, fortunately, did not come to pass. At the same level of moral imbecility, one would rush into the streets every October to sing praises to the Kremlin while ridiculing those who warned of the dangers of placing missiles in Cuba and persist in condemning the criminal lunacy of the act. Kennedy officials state the president had not authorized an invasion of Cuba. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, however, informed his cabinet associates on October 22, 1962, that the president ordered us to prepare an invasion months ago, and we have developed plans in great detail, fully enough so that an invasion could be launched in a week. At the 40th anniversary conference, McNamara reiterated his view that Cuba was justified in fearing an attack. "If I were in Cuban or Soviet shoes, I would have thought so too," he said.